This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. We've got something a little bit different and a little bit special this week. Kate, what's happening?
Well, Catherine, the rest of the world knows our guest today is an award-winning writer, author of six novels and now three non-fiction works, general wise sage of the Australian lit world. But you, dear listeners, and us know her as our one-time resident agony aunt, Charlotte Wood. Welcome back to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much, my short-lived agony aunt career.
You know what? They're still our highest rating episodes, so you're fine. You've done well for us.
I'm still obsessed with advice columns.
Oh, well, good. Anytime you feel like you need to come back, you know there's a spot waiting for you here. How are you going up there in Sydney town?
Well, we've all gone crazy, but we're surviving, and we do have a light at the end of our tunnel now, which is sort of probably making some of us even crazier, but it's good. We're allowed to have picnics as of last week. So I had a picnic on the weekend and it was very beautiful. The weather is getting warmer and more beautiful. So things are seemingly looking up
that
until
helps.
The next catastrophe happens.
Yeah, that helps. I love that we got our picnics and then we got like hailstorms and severe and damaging winds and it's about
freezing.
12 degrees.
So, Charlotte, while the rest of us spent COVID sitting on the couch watching TV, you actually wrote another book. It is called The Luminous Solution, Creativity, Resilience, and the Inner Life. Tell us, what is it about and who is it for?
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say I've wrote a whole new book.
I would claim that. I would very much claim
it. I kind of did in a way. So it's about creativity, and it's a series of, I'm calling them chapters instead of essays because I'm hoping it is a really fully formed book now. But these chapters come out of stuff that I've written over the past, 20 years. So each of the chapters sort of started life in some other published form, mostly. A couple of them have not been published before. And they're just different aspects of what I have come to understand about my own creative impulse, my instinct, my process, and then what I've observed of other writers and artists over all the years. So I've always been kind of obsessed with the creative process and how it works for different people and how different it is for different people. And then a few years ago, I did a PhD looking at cognitive processes of creativity. So cognitive psychology research about creativity, which I found very interesting. And so there's all just kind of different chapters about different parts of my writing life, really, but also how I've really drawn from painters and visual artists and just any creative field, really. And by that, I include things like scientists and builders and, I have some friends who run a sustainable ethical butchery and they're the most creative people I know, so business people, all kinds of people. So I really like this sort of cross-pollination idea, and I suppose that's what underlies a lot of the book.
It starts still in the pandemic with with the chapter of Fertile Ground, because who would have thought that we would still bloody be here? But you write in that chapter, Charlotte, about the fear of stillness, which is something that I think will just resonate with so many people right now, because I think people have been so struggling with it. But you go on to say that stillness is not a void, it's a well, and if you let it, it will fill itself. Can you tell us a bit about that well and how it does keep filling?
Yeah, it's funny you say that about it was written in the pandemic, which it was last year, 2020, sort of early in the pandemic. A version of that piece appeared in a newspaper, and it was about the kind of utter panic of finding myself in this completely unknown situation and how I rush around filling the time with you know, Zoom things and drinks and yoga classes and books and blah, blah, feeling in this sort of panic that I had to take in as much as I could and then pass it on and share it. And it was kind of exhausting. And when I was editing this book earlier this year, I was thinking, I don't know if this is going to be so relevant now. You know, the pandemic's kind of over and we're not in lockdown again. Then, whoa, bam, here we are. So, yeah, I realised that I couldn't sustain that level of sort of rushing about, panicking, basically. And it led me into thinking, well, this sort of constant movement and constant noise, which is what contemporary life is kind of designed to be by capitalism. You know, that I think I say somewhere that capitalism loves panic more than anything because it sort of destabilizes everybody. You rush around buying stuff to make yourself feel better, even if it's things like books and, you know, Netflix and whatever that we think are sort of, you know, sort of posher things. But they're still, depending on how you do it, you can be just as indiscriminate in your consumption of those things. So I was talking about how I had forced myself to just stop and go still, which is, you know, the natural state of writers when they're working well, I think, and all artists. You need to go into that interior space, to the quiet place in yourself. And I think early in the pandemic, especially, there was a feeling that this should be kind of easy for us. This is, you know, I work at home all the time. I work on my own. I'm used to being isolated in inverted commas. And of course, in the end, it's thrown all of us for a loop and it hasn't been easy. But that essay goes on to talk about, well, what does happen in the creative mind and what are the things that help that stillness and what are the things that that hinder it? But the stillness is scary. And every time, you know, I've been doing this for 20, 30 years or something, and every time I have to go into that calm, still space, I still get scared of it. And, you know, I still can't really work out why. But I guess it's that you have to be so self-sustaining in that quiet place. But it is the only way for creativity to really happen. And, you know, that idea of the well comes from Annie Dillard, and she said something like, but when she, I think it's the bit where she talks about don't save things for later, spend it all, because your creativity is a well and it will fill itself. She said these things fill from behind and from beneath like well water. So I guess I've sort of taken on that idea. And that, but you can't, if you're stuffing the well with things from the external world all the time, it won't fill itself. It's just blocked up with crap. So it takes a lot of practice, as you both know, and to just remember that it's the quiet space where those, you know, creative leaps and visions happen. And it, for me, it's, you know, I have to really guard that space, and I'm really still really bad at guarding it at certain times, but I do know that that's when I will, you know, get stuff that works for a book.
It made me go immediately to my shelf and pull down Vicky Hastrich's Night Fishing, which I know, you know, is a book close to your heart, and read that section on going fallow as well, because it's for slightly different purposes, but it felt like, yes, I can put those two things together, the stillness and the going fallow.
Absolutely. And it's not being afraid of space and silence. I think we're so conditioned in contemporary life that if there's silence, it means something's wrong, so we have to suddenly fill it up. And Vicky Hastrich's book, Night Fishing, is a wondrous piece of work, incredibly inspiring for any writer, any artist, I think. And her sort of project of going fallow when she was having real trouble with the book and just deciding to stop everything, stop working, possibly give up writing, but just absorb the work of other artists. It's really, it's a magnificent essay. And it turned into the book in the end because her well did fill in the most beautiful way.
Charlotte, one of the chapters I keep thinking about is one of the early ones on objects. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean when you're using the word objects and what objects can do within a piece of work? You talk through the tapestries example in the natural way of things, but I guess I just was really interested in this idea of the way writers kind of can pick images or smells or things from the world around them. They appear in the novel and then they kind of take on a new meaning or have a narrative function even.
Yes, I do use objects a lot. And I think the first person I heard ever really talking about this really consciously was Helen Garner. And in the interview years ago, which she said, she was talking about the spare room. She said, if you just notice objects enough and sort of let them be, they do a hell of a lot of work for you. And she was talking about sort of domestic objects like making beds and, you know, things in a garden and whatever. And then in The Luminous Solution, I talk a bit about Uta Hagen, the American acting teacher, very famous acting teacher. And she talks about something called inner objects, which are sort of things that you might carry inside yourself, memories of something when you were a kid, or I think she talks about, you know, polka dots on a sweater or sort of little things like that. That if you kind of, I mean, she talks about not expressing them, but just sort of holding them inside yourself. It's really complex and interesting. But when I was writing The Natural Way of Things, I took on the inner objects idea as a way of kind of accessing some of the kind of weirder, more metaphorical, more symbolic things, I guess. So in The Natural Way of Things, which was my book about kind of horrible girls' prison in the middle of nowhere, prison for young women who'd been sort of sexually molested in some way and then blamed for it, which is pure fantasy. Of course, that never happened. So in that book, I used things like a little brown trout or rabbits, or there was a doll that the girls made out of sort of straw and sticks and hair and stuff. And there was a white horse that one of the girls, Verla, kept seeing. And there was a, you know, question of was the horse real, was it not real? So I guess they sort of, they transmit and evoke layers of meaning that aren't necessarily immediately apparent. And if you get an object that is sort of inner enough or idiosyncratic enough, then it allows the reader to really sort of make their own meaning around it, I think. Not sure if I'm explaining this very well, but it's sort of, if you have an object that's already highly symbolic, like, I don't know, a knife or something, it already carries a whole lot of sort of almost objective meaning. But if you transfer that in your novel to something just sort of tangentially related, or that isn't even related in other people's minds, but it's related in your mind, then you can sort of create this sort of series, a sort of visual language or physical language for a whole lot of meanings and themes and concerns of your work without spelling it all out. So I like the way that objects sort of carry meaning that has to be sort of slowly understood maybe by the reader.
Because it's an extraordinary kind of gift we don't often get to go back into a writer's process and so unpack the way they made something.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, I worry that there might be a bit too much about the natural way of things in there, but it's, that book taught me so much about how I work and how, I guess, it was a real breakthrough for me, not just in terms of, you know, my book doing well for the first time ever, but in kind of accepting stuff about what my unconscious mind was trying to tell me, and finally learning that a book will tell you how to write it if you pay attention to it, if you listen to it, if you let it come, rather than, you know, I'd always kind of wrangled things to the ground and been very controlling about my own creative process. But with The Natural Way of Things, I was kind of forced by it not working to just let it be what it needed to be, which was something that I did not want it to be, which was very, you know, quite scary to me. But by the end of it, I'd really learned that was incredibly valuable to have that understanding kind of forced upon me. And then I wanted to kind of really examine it to see how I would, the things that I would take forward into other books and the things that I wanted to forget about.
The objects can kind of work to reinforce the themes of the book, but they give you space as a writer to sort of step to the side in some ways, is how it kind of felt to me.
And they sort of let you not know things. I think that's kind of important. Like the doll for me was just in so for people who haven't read it, the imprisoned girls are there with these horrible male guards who, and sooner or later you realise that, you know, these guys are not going to hang around without wanting something sexual from these women who they have completely under their control. So one of the girls ends up sort of sacrificing herself, basically. But she says, all right, I'll do this, but you have to get me a doll. And, you know, it's very weird. But it allowed me to, like, I could just go, okay, this is what's going to happen. And it was just this really kind of almost brute symbol of girlhood, stuff about women that I just let pour out of my head that were kind of primitive, physical. And so it was about giving birth, it was about having babies, it was about being a frightened child, it was about the doll became, I think in one place in the novel I say, you know, what is this thing that they make? It's a sort of voodoo doll, it's a goddess, it's a child substitute. It could be all these different things. But if I had tried to make sense of suddenly thinking there's got to be a creepy doll in this book, if I'd tried to make logical sense of it, it wouldn't have then allowed all those different meanings to sort of accrete around it. Because that's why objects are so useful.
I want to ask about the process that you went through, and this is part of your thesis, which I have to admit that I have gone back to read in its entirety because I'm a total nerd. So you decided to look at the creative process, you're writing the natural way of things, you're meeting with your wonderful writers group, and you decide to kind of extrapolate from these meetings with them some different techniques in the creative process. And like, honestly, for people who haven't yet decided that they're already going to buy the book, the 9 techniques are the reason I would go and buy it immediately just to put them up on your wall as well, because I think they're so interesting. We won't go into all of them because people need to go and buy the book. But I want to ask you about heat seeking, because you say that heat seeking is kind of the first one you talk about and the most important. And I think the most interesting thing to me about it is the fact that it's a incendiary kind of a process. Like, it starts you off, but it also is something you keep dipping back into throughout the creative process. Can you talk to us a little bit about heat seeking and these kind of techniques around it?
Yeah. Well, it's very strongly related to what we were just talking about. So this PhD I ended up doing a very small longitudinal study of 5 writers to see if there were processes they used common to them all that they didn't know they were using. And so we had these conversations and I recorded them and coded them and sort of looked through and came up in the end with that there were these common processes. Not all of them use them all the time, but they were enunciated in different ways, and there were 9 different, basically 9 creative ways to think is how I've phrased it in this book. And heat seeking turned out to be the most central. And it's basically, it's really simple. It's just going with the thing that tugs at you, that makes you, that sort of holds your attention. But the important thing is that you don't have to know why. It doesn't have to make any sense. And I think often when you start writing, you think, oh, I kind of like that, you know, black dog. But that's got nothing to do with my novel about Paris, banking system. So you discount it. So when you discount it, you're not paying attention to your intuition and your instinctive impulse, which is the very heart of art. You know, that's what artists are, is instinctive people who then later on, often at the same time, but, you know, there are the 2 kinds of thinking, the divergent thinking, which is this all this sort of weird, nonsensical dark, murky just instinct. And then there's convergent thinking, which is shaping all of those and making them make sense and be plausible and all that. So heat seeking is really just a way of talking about following the spark of anything that stays with you. And you could have different sparks at different stages of a book. But quite often in my study, and I've seen it since, and I've seen it in people I've mentored and all kinds of different places, often a writer will have some element in the book that isn't working, but they know that they don't want to let it go. And so what I've learned is pay attention to that not wanting to let it go, because it means there's something important there for you. Mm. And quite often it'll be something that you haven't worked out how to integrate properly. So another reader or an editor or someone will say, that bit's not working, take it out. And then you take it out and the book still doesn't work. Because it actually is this engine for the book, but you just haven't worked out why yet. So heat seeking, it's often talked about in my study, people referred to it as goodness or juice or spark, or there's some substance there. It had this sort of feeling of a little glowing coal or something. Mm. And what I have learned now is that, and it's often the real basis of when you start something, you know, people often talk about a book started when I saw a woman in the street, you know, wearing a, I don't know, paisley dress. And then they go on to write something else, but they keep thinking about that paisley dress. So that's the heat, is the paisley dress. So it's sort of at the basis of all these other different processes and ways of thinking. And to me, it is the most important one. Because I've said in the book that quite often I'll read a novel and I'll think they never found their heat. You know, it doesn't have that sense of energy at the center of it. And it doesn't, like, the reader doesn't even really have to know what your heat seeking, your heat is, but you have to know. And you have to have the guts to follow it, you know, because quite often you think, oh, that's not going to work, or I've gotten so far doing this, that's just going to ruin the whole book. I'll have to take it all apart again. But to me, it's important. So say in the natural way of things, like this thing about rabbits, like what did that have to do with anything? But it seemed to have this sort of shimmer of meaning about, you know, birth and animality and escape and all these different things were around that one sort of creature for me. And it often seems so in The Weeknd, there's a dog in my novel The Weeknd, which is about three older women friends kind of annoying each other over a weekend. The dog was very central in that story. But it could be anything. It could be just anything. And it's only the important thing is that it's your thing. Mm. That you know, some part of you knows that it's important. And it's trusting that knowing, I suppose.
And I think you're right in saying about the instinct and that muscle of recognizing, you know, trusting that instinct and the intuition that this is something. I was thinking for writers who are reading the book, there's that element of kind of Charlotte sitting behind you going, yes, you know, follow that thing. That isn't, you know, that is a thing, even though there's so much in your logical brain which is telling you that will never work.
Yeah. And I guess the luminous solution is kind of centrally about this tension between logical brain and sort of dreamy, you know, kind of ghostly brain. And I think you really need both of those. That's why writing is so great, because you use every single part of your brain, whereas in so many other jobs you only use the rational part and you're not allowed to use that weird, dreamy, kind of crazy part. You need them both as an artist.
Charlotte, another kind of tension that is contained within the luminous solution is in the chapter Letting in the Light, and you describe a paradox at the heart of the artist's work, the need for absolute privacy and the fear of exposure, while knowing at the same time that soon this exposure is the very thing we most want and need. I feel like so many of our listeners will relate to this. Certainly, I know I do. This is also something that you say has preoccupied you for a long time. How do you know when to share your work?
Good question. Well, I'm sort of better at hanging on to it for longer now. In the beginning, when I first started writing, you know, you're so anxious about everything. But I think in the beginning, you're not, well, I certainly wasn't gutsy enough to go, I'm in this for years and years before it's going to work. I need to know now if it's going to work. So I need to show somebody this, you know, paragraph for them to say, oh, yes, it's going to work.
And I feel so seen.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know, I think it's part of the deal, and we all do that. But the longer you go on, the more self-reliant you get, I think. And so now I wouldn't show anybody a first draft of anything ever. I would at least do... So even say an essay or something for a magazine or something, I would do at least two or three drafts. And if I thought there was still a problem with it, then I'd show one of these writer friends of mine who have different kinds of brains. So usefully I'll go to one for one sort of thing and the other for something else. But I'm also just better now at trusting all of that stuff we were just talking about. You know, in my early days, I'd think, well, I've got this rabbit, but it doesn't make any sense. So can you tell me what to do with it, you know, and show it to somebody? And they wouldn't know either because it didn't make any sense because I hadn't yet discovered what it meant. So nowadays I would go probably maybe 3/4 of the way through a book's completion. Basically, I go for as long as I can by myself. And then when I get to a point where I think, oh, just A, I hate this so much, I need to remove it from me. Mm. And sometimes just doing that will solve problems. I will often give it to one of these, you know, 3 or 4 people to read. But it is getting longer and longer, the time, which is kind of good. Sometimes I think, ooh, I'm getting dangerous now. I'm just going off willy-nilly and finishing things without getting any approval, which of course my hope is a sign of some sort of maturity. But also, I tell you what you get better at is caring what you think about it more than what other people think about it. And I recently was watching a fantastic, beautiful documentary about Rosalie Gascoigne, the visual artist. And she said, she's not alive anymore. Whenever I put a show together, my question is it self-respecting? And if it's self-respecting, then it can go ahead. And I'm very rigorous about that self-respect. You know, she was very tough on herself. But then what other people think is really no consequence. You know, that's a pretty fantastic place to get to. Mm. And I think a lot of us never get to that place. But, you know, the more you go on and you realise all the rewards that you thought were going to be there in the beginning are not there, you know, are probably... very likely never going to come, like wild international success or
what?
Know, prizes or
that's what we're waiting for. Don't tell us that.
Well, you probably will get that. But you know, you think people will love you or you'll make money or all those things that after a while you go, oh, it seems, and it can be very, you know, very dispiriting to get to a certain point and think, oh, all those things are not going to happen. So then you think, well, why am I doing this? And then you remember why you ever started doing it. When, you know, when you didn't have any expectations and it was just sort of fun and pleasure and or not so much fun but immensely satisfying. And that's what will still drive you way down the track. But also you learn, you're much better at your craft and there are, you know, techniques and things that you've learned along the way that hopefully make you a better artist then, so you can trust your own self-respecting impulse.
I love the anecdote where you talk about someone, another writer who you don't name, telling you after The Natural Way of Things that you'd gone feral, and you take this as a great compliment. And of course, I mean, even what you've talked about just now, in The Natural Way of Things, there is an element of feralness at that literal meaning of the word. But you talk about it as a quality of work and particularly in relation to women artists as well. Mm. How might we bring out the feralness of our own work or recognise it?
I did love that. Actually, it was Malcolm Knox who said that, and he it's on the cover somewhere, so you know, it's not a secret.
Okay. But
and I was very, very thrilled to be described as feral, because I'd always felt myself to be so timid and sort of, you know, anxious and all of that. So my idea of a feral artist, and I've got a sort of list of people in who I see as feral or unruly or sort of wild in some way, and they are people like I think Rosalie Gascoigne is one, the painter Lucy Cullerton is another one, even though her work isn't terribly feral, but she's kind of feral. Who else? Sylvie Guillaume, the ballerina, who was just a wild animal, basically. Other artists like Carla Dickens and Alexis Wright, you know. And I guess I was looking at, well, what's common between these people? And one of the first things was this utter trust in their own instinct. Mm. It seemed to me from the outside, even if, you know, maybe they do spend a lot of time doubting it. But I feel like at their level of achievement and accomplishment, they have fully accepted their own peculiar sort of nature. And so they will do quite, you know, Carla Dickens's incredible artworks. I have one on my wall, which is a pair of cast aluminium underpants with ribbons all over it and then hanging with emu feathers in this kind of, it's kind of like a super warrior outfit come sort of tribal costume come whimsical, you know, it's very strange. And but to, I mean, I can't speak for Carla, obviously, but having met her and talked to her about her work, there's just this certainty that, oh, that's what I have to do. And it's kind of normal. And so, you know, Rosalie Gascoigne picking up bits of old tin and seeing them as a landscape, like, of course that's what you see. So there's this kind of self-acceptance of there's nothing weird about what I'm doing. It's just almost, it's just natural. So I feel like they have I feel like all the ones that I've mentioned in the book have a really deep connection with the natural world, a kind of earthiness and a lack of shame about things like bodies and the sort of the animal quality in themselves. And that thing of being self-respecting, you know, Alexis Bright writing Carpenteria, you know, you have to be full of power and make your own confidence to think, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I know that probably no one will want to publish it because it's so wild and so unlike, you know, ordinary traditional Western storytelling modes. It does not happen in that book. So she's kind of invented her own form of literature, seems to me. So, and, you know, she's written about kind of losing heart but knowing that that's what she had to do. And, of course, then it was published and it went to huge acclaim. But it's sort of, and Vicky Hastrich has this. She's pretty feral. I haven't put her in there. But just knowing your own path and sticking to it and being unashamed about it and unapologetic about it. And I think for women it's harder because it's harder to, you know, you are judged differently. We all know that. And also you know, I'm sure your daughters are not being raised this way, but I suspect all of us were raised not necessarily by our parents but by the culture. And your generation's younger than me to be nice and helpful.
Be nice.
And
yes.
Not upset people.
Yeah.
And not just don't cause any problems for anyone. Just be easy to work with and blah, 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 all of that. And, you know, lots of that is great. But in your art, there's a very damaging impulse. Being gutsy enough to go, okay, this might upset and offend some people, but I'm going to do it.
I think that danger and risk, and I'm thinking about it because I've just shared today an amazing article from Mona Al-Tahawi about the way we raise little girls, and it's to do with Simone Biles and the cases against the gym asshole. But about, you know, teaching them about the volcano inside themselves and erupting and all of those words and danger and risk, which I think is at the core of that feralness that you talk about today. I'll put it in the show notes for people as well. You just talked then about the natural world and the chapter, The Rapture.
Which I realize now has kind of rather alarming religious.
Well, that's in your background, isn't it, Charlotte? You can't help these things coming out, right?
That's right. But Catholics don't tend to believe in the rapture. But, you know, whatever, let's go with it.
But I think the word, so I'm doing that thing that you tell us to do in heat seeking, which is to pay attention to words that are coming up around me, because the word that is coming up around me a lot at the moment, and we talked about it in the interview with Maggie Shipstead and with Brooke McCallery, is awe. And this recognition of awe and the seeking of awe, often in the natural world. But I want to ask you now, as we enter our, what are we at, Catherine, here? Whatever. Feels like 800 days of lockdown, but at a time when lots of people around the world are prevented from being in the places where they would normally seek awe, how do we get that experience, that kind of rapture feeling within 5Ks?
Well, you know, if you are lucky enough, as I am, to have a very tiny garden, if I was in an apartment and had a pot of basil on the windowsill, I'd be freaking looking at that basil as much as I could. The sky. You know, a few weeks ago in lockdown here, we bought an exercise bike, which I'm sure will turn into one of those things that is a terrible reminder of lockdown and never seen again. But I put it in the backyard and I was on it, and it was that thing of really, you know, working hard. But I was looking up at the sky, and we have some trees around our house and clouds, and it was, you know, it was almost one of those moments, even though, you know, we felt really trapped. But it doesn't, I don't know, does it have to be the natural world?
I don't think it does.
I mean, it could be space. It could be, I think the thing about the natural world that gives it to you so easily is that it's big and it's also microscopic. Like the scope of it is vast. And what I love in that you know, the chapter when I talk about going on the walk and is being in the presence of something much bigger than yourself and ancient that doesn't care if you exist or not. That's what I like about being out in nature. You know, this cliff top that I walk along has been there for how many thousands of years, and it puts our existence in perspective, which is, okay, we're going to be gone, but this will still be here. And I love that. It'll be here, you know, in some form, even if we, you know, go on in the terrible way that we are, so destructively. But the you know, the earth might become uninhabitable for humans, but the earth will be here. But also, you know, I'm doing a lot of kind of really micro gardening at the moment, and I've never been so conscious of every tiny leaf in my tiny, tiny courtyard garden. And it just gives me enormous pleasure. But it could be, I do get it in art as well. You know? So wherever you find it, I guess, wherever you find it, but just seeking it out is it's good. It does something to your head. And I think for me, it's that thing of feeling small in the face of something big or eternal or ancient. Or, you know, when I went on this whale watching thing years ago, and I thought, you know, this sort of touristy thing. Oh my God, I've never forgotten when this whale corkscrewed out sort of vertically out of the water, and not in a big splashy way, just in a really quiet, it was like this incredible prehistoric being rising up and looking at us and then going down again. It was just, you know, I'm sort of touching my chest here because you feel it in your body. That's the kind of awe I'm talking about, I guess.
And maybe I think the ocean does that so well, doesn't it? Like, it's that immersiveness of it, I think, that really kind of...
And the vastness of it. And I realized in the end of that piece where, you know, because when I was younger, I was kind of afraid of the ocean, and I'm still afraid of big ocean. But that realizing by the end of that piece of writing that when I get in the ocean now, I feel this incredible sense of astonishment that this bit of water is connected to the bit of water outside my cousin's place in Scotland, you know, or it's all joined up. This great connection is just astounding and very moving to me now.
I will never take the ocean for granted again. Oh, access to the ocean.
Yeah.
Because this book is in memory of your friend, the writer Georgia Blaine. And I still actually have on my wall, which has moved from my tiny little non-writing space into my big writing space, the article that you wrote for the Saturday paper after Georgia's death. And I read it often, partly because it's a reminder to me, to myself, not to take friendships for granted. And in it you write, enduring friendships, I read recently, have three phases: enchantment, necessary disenchantment, mature consolidation. Dearest G, I wish we'd had time for all three, but with you, I only ever made it to the first. It's the most beautiful piece of writing. And I wanted to ask you about how Georgia Blaine did enchant you, and or what you might hope that readers take away from the chapter you've included in your book about her and her final works.
Oh, you made me cry.
Sorry.
No, it's nice, actually. Georgia was just so great. She was a beautiful writer. And one of the things that was so sad about her going was that she was just getting better and better. That's, you know. Anyway, so the book, Between a Wolf and a Dog, her last novel, of course, while she was sick, she wrote another book, astonishingly, called The Museum of Words. So the piece that's in The Luminous Solution is the profile I wrote of Georgia when her book came out, because one of the first things I thought when I knew she was ill and that her book was coming out was that I didn't want her to suddenly become brain tumor woman, you know, publicly. I wanted her work to be read and properly talked about. So I asked the Herald if I could write a profile of her. And so that way I felt, you know, I told her that she could really change anything she wanted or whatever, so that she felt safe enough to have this, because she was, you know, this was not long after she had discovered that she had this terminal brain cancer. So what I would love people to take away is go and read her work, go and read her, especially read the last two books and then work your way back. She was hilariously funny. She was so real about the writing life. We would often sort of get together and, you know, roar with laughter about some humiliating episode that had just happened at, you know, festival or whatever. Everybody loved her. She was so forthright. You know, you never had to pussyfoot around her or anything. And, you know, when the conversation that I had with her to write that piece, we laughed a lot. You know, we were talking about her approaching death and we were laughing because she's just amazing. I mean, I sort of do run out of words. And I'm conscious that I was a sort of relatively new friend of George's. There are friends of hers who might listen to this and think, well, you don't even really know her like I do. And I accept that. But we spent some really amazing time together, like in a couple of years before she got sick and then afterwards. But one thing that we always laughed about together was how she was always getting in trouble for not having likable characters. and she would say, oh, I really liked that one. You know, I thought she'd say, this time I'm going to write a book with likable women in it. And then, you know, they'd be kind of women like her. And then she'd think, oh, that was quite like me. And everyone's saying, oh, she's awful, that one. So, and I love in that piece that's in my book, as she says, you know, I've always been told I write too much about the privileged middle class and my characters are not likable. And it used to really worry me, but now I couldn't give a rat's ass. And I think that is, you know, words to live by for any writer.
What's next? Where can listeners find out if you're teaching, talking, dropping new podcasts, or are you going to go back in the cave?
Well, I want to go back in the cave. I'm not teaching. I want to do more podcasting, but I also want to get back to writing. I want to get back to my novel. My novel that feels like, because of COVID, it's had about 10 false starts. And it'll be interesting to see if that has done it any good or if it's just totally ruined.
So has it been sitting, waiting for you to return to it?
It's waiting. It's calling me. So, it, you know, so I say, I'll get there and it's like, I don't want to see you. Yeah, I've got about, I don't know, 35,000 words or something. But I will be, so, you know, I was supposed to be doing a 6-week book tour for The Luminous Solution, which is no more, obviously. I'm doing some talking at a couple of the events.
You are out and about. You are talking with none other than Helen Garner of Scrub Bashing. Oh. I keep on underlining Scrub Bashing whenever you...
Yeah, that's a Garnerism.
That's a Garnerism. So you're talking with Helen Garner at Readings on the 5th of October.
That's
and
right.
And this crazy woman called Kate Mildenhall, you're talking to her. I don't even know if you know that yet.
That's so exciting. I do know that. That is
That's
wonderful.
For Eltham Bookshop on October the 7th.
And I'm talking with Chrissy Neen, an avid reader.
Mate, people should go to all of them. Charlotte Wood, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you back on the First Time Podcast.
So fun to be back with you guys and see your faces.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.